There we go. Saving the worst for first. Can I take my mask off at the podium?
I think you can.
Yeah, okay, good. So there I was. I worked on in Hollywood for many years. I'm a creative person right there on Sunset Boulevard. I'm a graphic designer by trade. And Diane and I were dating. And she would pick me up in her Ford Galaxy, about a 1968. The block long job, right? And one morning she picked me up and I was so sick. I was going through withdrawals. I'm not somebody who shakes a lot, but if I was somebody who shakes a lot, I would have been shaking. I just felt so bad. And I said to her, look, I'm sorry, but I'm sick and I need a drink and I don't have any money. And my date that day pulled out a roll of $100 bills and she says, oh, I'll take care of you. That was the very moment I fell in love. She would pick me up from the studio there on Sunset Boulevard, and it was very just a short hop over to Griffith Park, where we would go to Griffith Park. And she would bring a picnic basket with a loaf of crusty bread, some brie or camembert at room temperature, and two bottles of wine. Who needs two bottles of wine at lunch, right? Well, I do. I almost never came back from lunch. So we did, and this is a true story. I don't have to exaggerate anything. So we dated about 30 days or maybe 40 days, and we were married. And we were both, we got married and we drank together for a year. And that during that year, she took me to the emergency hospital with organ failure from drinking. That's all you have to do. Because I had been arrested so many times, I figured if I just stay home, I can drink all I want. Here's an alcoholic with a plan, right? But the problem with that is if I drink all I want, I'm going to get very sick. So she would take me to the hospital, Hollywood Community Hospital, and they would bring me in. And I couldn't stay away from it. I just couldn't leave it alone. Stuart, why don't you just leave it alone? I don't know. And the doctor says, if you ever take another drink, you'll die. Them doctors are always saying that. We're very nearly right. Finally, my boss pulls us both in into the conference room. And my boss, I'm a key employee. And at this time, I'm production manager for this whole studio of designers. And my poor boss, he's got his head in his hands. And he's just going, oh, my God. He says, I can't take it anymore. I said, you can't take it. You can't take it. It's killing me. So he sent us both to rehab. Care unit of Warren's right there on Tustin Boulevard. And that's where we began our journey. So we drank together for a year. We spent our first anniversary in care unit of Orange. Very romantic, I know. Well, I followed almost all of the rules, not all of them. Hey, you shut up. I came into contact with the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never talked to people like this before. And In retrospect, Diane tells me that I was the first person. In those days, we had a phone booth out in the hall, right? So if I wanted to talk to somebody, I'd go to the phone booth, put some quarters in, and I would call her, and I said something very typical that a newcomer might say. I said, I don't know if I'm going to drink again. And for a newcomer, that's a pretty profound statement. And she said, I'm the first person who ever spoke to her in the language of the heart. And that scared her. Because I forgot to mention that at that time we lived right in front of the dam there in Silver Lake. Thank you, dear. So, Silver Lake, right around the corner from the liquor store. And I would send her over to the liquor store, and she would go get the liquor before, hurry up and get down there before they close, right? Before they lock the cabinet. And then she would come back, and, you know, she would hide. I'm a bad drunk, but she would hide her bottles from me. All that time she was hiding, she would wait until I pass out, and then she'd start on her booze. So I never knew what a bad drunk that she was. I'm telling off here, but I came into contact with the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was so sick and so tired. Just all the fight had gone out of me. And by speaking strictly for myself, this is really a one-step program. You're going to surrender, or you're going to keep fighting. And all the fight had gone out of me. I just didn't have one more excuse. I couldn't look at my boss and lie to him one more time. I couldn't make one more excuse. He knows I'm lying. I know I'm lying. Everybody knows I'm lying. And I was just so ashamed. I was so ashamed. All the fight had gone out of me. And I just accepted it. I just accepted it. And that's where our thing began. And we both grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. We did. And she got, I met a new person. We evolved, and time went by. And I want to say that everything good in my life is a direct result of my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I say nothing else, it's everything came to me through Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was near the end, really. The last three times I took a drink, I went to the hospital. And where's the bottom from that? Well, the morgue is in the basement. I know what's ahead of me. She knew what's ahead of me. And she was scared because I was dying. And I couldn't stay away from it. And Alcoholics Anonymous showed me, and showed me a way to get free, because I had terrible cravings. I just couldn't get past those cravings, because they would grind me down hour after hour, day after day. Eventually, I would give in to the cravings and drink again. And then I'd be back in the hospital wondering what happened to me. So we grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we both had our crises in AA, and I came to a very painful point where I had drifted away from the fellowship. I wasn't into service. I was missing meetings. I never drank, but I'll never know how close I was. I'll never know how close I came, because my judgment is a little bit up to question to begin with, right? So I was just eaten up with resentment and playing that continuous tape in my mind, just alive with resentment. And I went to the old hole in the sky on Topanga in Sherman Way, and I went upstairs and I just had my head in my hands. I said, I can't go on like this. I'm just eaten up with resentment. I said, what am I gonna do? There were a couple old timers just sitting there, and they said, you know what you got to do. You know what you have to do. That's all they said. They didn't pat me on the shoulder. They didn't say, there, it's going to be okay, because it wasn't okay, and it wasn't going to be okay. I had to make another surrender, a deeper surrender. There's always more. There's always more to give up. And I got more involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, started being of service, getting into the panels. Nowadays, Diane does her prison panels. I do my prison panels, and sometimes we go together when they're open. And we take great joy in that. great joy to the promises come true for us. I'm the guy who would sit and drink all night looking at a huge console TV in 1979, just drinking all night long, movies till dawn. Just, I hated everyone, and the sun would come up, and it would be a gray day, and I'd say, oh no, another day. And look at me now. I can't believe the words that are coming out of my mouth. I like meeting new people. How did that happen? But I'm interested in helping other people because I'm a selfish person, and I get something out of it. You know, my buddy Rick and some of us, we take panels into the different fire camps because that's what's open now. Holton and Francisquito and Acton. And I always say, you know, this to the inmates, I say, you know, this panel is going to be wildly successful because we're going home sober tonight. And that's why we're doing it, right? My job is to carry the message. What you do with it is your prerogative, but I know it's going to work for me. It's just like when Bill went out day after day after day, and he come home to Lois, and he says, it's no good. It's not working. I can't find anybody. I can't help anybody. And she says, oh, yeah, Bill, you kept one person sober. Who's that? You. Ah. So it's in that act of being of service that really I found my salvation. To be of use, just to feel useful once again. You can't write a check for that. You can't buy that. And I just love that. How am I doing on time? I got 5 minutes. Okay. So I took a... I took a panel to all of you psych unit for many years, lockdown psych unit. And, you know, we are not a glum lot, and I loved that panel, and I did it for many years. And I would always go to Costco and get the muffins with the nuts in them. And those people are so starved for humor, they'll laugh at anything. I mean, really, even my corny jokes. And I would take the muffins up, and I'd say, hey, I got some nuts for the nuts. And they would laugh, and think that's hilarious. And the lady with her wrists all bandaged up from her suicide attempt, right? She's sitting across from me, and she's pointing to the other inmate, and she goes to the other inmate. That person's crazy, right? Oh, it's such a hoot, right? It's such a hoot, and it's such wonderful training. I say that because carrying a meeting into that place, there's nothing those inmates can say to me that's going to make me angry because I know they're sick. What wonderful training, right? That you can't buy that. That's the best training in the world. And I had such great time up there. And I always tell us, it's been years now, but I'll tell this story anyway. So I go do the panel, and afterwards, a cute little girl would come up to me. She said, oh, Stuart, I really liked your talk. And she would twirl her hair and pop her gum and bat the eyelashes at me. And she would say, are you single? And I puff my chest out, right? Because I like a compliment, right? I would say, no, dear, I'm very happily married. She'd say, oh, because my grandma is single. So she just lifts me up, right? Okay, good. And it just crushed my spirit, right? I had so much fun. I goof at anything. I don't take myself too seriously. I really don't. And I'm not intimidated by you people at all, because some of you, I knew you before you had teeth. Oh, you know who you are. We have a great time. And we joke about all kinds of inappropriate laughter. This is the home of inappropriate laughter. I mean, we love that stuff, right? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything good has come to me. And our journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has been so astounding. Diane would be on the phone talking, laughing and talking and laughing and talking and to her girlfriends and all the people in her women's group, and I'd be sit there, nobody's calling me. I'd be jealous because I've heard of people that would grow apart in a marriage, right? They just develop different interests. And I love my wife. And I didn't want that to happen. So that's one of the reasons I got. But plus, I was jealous of what she had. I was jealous of the fellowship that she had. And I want that too. And we have that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are people who normally would not mix. And we don't care. We don't care. We don't care if you come from Yale or jail or it's just the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And I am grateful. I am grateful for this spiritual life because it is not one I would have ever chosen. You know, I'm a person that never gave it a thought. Any kind, much of a thought, a spiritual way of life. But if I'm backed into a corner like I was, with no place else left to go, that's why I chose this life, because it was the only thing left to me. And I'm so glad that the God of my understanding, and by the way, we don't care what you believe. You can be an atheist, you can be a mugwump, we don't care. It's not what I believe, it's what I do. Right? Because faith without works is what? Well, it's dead. It means you may as well not have it. May as well not have it. So take action. And regard, I've learned to trust Alcoholics Anonymous more and more. Against my instincts, sometimes I just pause and say, okay, what would be the AA way? What would be the AA way to handle this? And try to choose that. And, you know, I'm choking up. Every time I do that, it always comes out right. It always comes out right. Thank you.
Thank you. How about rebuttal? Diane? This is a woman I love so very, very much.
I got to have this all the time. This is too cool. The microphone that, you know, I mean, seriously. Okay, so I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 1980. Again, thank you, Harriet. I'm in good company this weekend. Thank you, Sandy B. Thank you, Todd G. Thank you, everybody. You know, that's helped to put this thing together. It's just amazing. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a whole new life. So up to the time I started drinking early, and I was a blackout drinker because when I started drinking, I got thirsty from the beginning. And this was a new ambition, a new obsession. Up to that point, I'd just been, you know, I'd been a Girl Scout. I'd been in the church choir and the Girl Scout choir. I sang a lot. I had a relationship with God. It was an important relationship for me because my childhood was, you know, it wasn't ideal. My dad was a hospital drinker, like my husband. My mother was just pissed. So me and my sisters would try and keep clear of those people. They were mean. But so when I had the opportunity to drink for the first time, I just, You know, I felt like I didn't care. I didn't care about anything. That was a nice solution. And as I had the opportunity to drink a little bit more, I thought, okay, I'm going to stop being the nice guy at home. I'm going to be the one who causes the trouble. And that's the way that it worked out. So I'm like, I don't know. And my father, he kept going to the hospital, and he'd go on a run, and then he'd be in the hospital for 2-3 months. Then he'd come back out, you know, skinny and, you know, chastened. And he'd work for a little while, and then it would happen again. So his doctor prescribed Tylenol. Tylenol. And the one that starts with an N. Anyway, the yellow pills, the red pills, and, you know, and Tylenol. So... And so he stopped drinking because he had a sufficient solution, right? Strong barbiturates. But about that time was when I started drinking. So it was an interesting switch in the household. So I became the registered a-hole in the house. And, I like that feeling. I like that power. I like the power that comes from anger. People are going to back up. Even though I'm, you know, an angry teenage girl, which is practically an oxymoron. But anyway, I mean, no, it's more like a stereotype. Anyway, so, you know, I was drinking as much as I could. And then I put on the, you know, the rest of the stuff, because this is the late 60s. So there was, well, it's not like there isn't everything now. But I just want to be drunk and loaded all the time. And like I say, all my associations changed. And my behavior changed, and my attitude changed, and the clothes I was wearing changed. And I started looking for opportunities to avoid the witnesses. So I lasted until, well, my mother kicked me out when I was 18, just turned 18. And you know, I think I... my hat's off that I lasted that long, but for her. But I started hitchhiking back and forth across the country, and then down through Mexico, and many adventures ensued, needless to say. So, you know those anti-promises that we read about in We Agnostics? Can't be of any real use. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't keep a place to stay. I couldn't trust myself. That was a big one. I couldn't trust myself. So when I told you I hitchhiked back and forth across the country, like I thought it was Jack Kerouac in On the Road, I knew from when I was 18 years old that I could trust a stranger, whoever pulled over to pick me up, more than I could trust myself, because I reliably would get myself in dangerous situations. Since I couldn't keep a job, I had to attach myself to somebody. And I did. I attached myself to a guy that was, I mean, perfect for me at the time. He was a bartender and a Coke dealer. So... That's a solution that they don't have in Chapter 3, but I really think it's, I mean, it's a natural, right? So I traveled with that guy for 4 years because I knew from the beginning I didn't like him. And I didn't want to get involved. So that seemed like a perfect solution. I just, you know, didn't like him anyway. So, you know, if he falls off the cliff, what do I care? So we moved to Hawaii and we grew pot. And that was, again, that was an occupation that was perfect for me at the time, because I didn't like people. I didn't trust people. I liked firearms, and I was all bloaty because I was coming off a period of time when I was drinking around the clock, which, let's face it, that's like work, you know, come to half drunk, drink, pass out, come to half drunk, it gets old. So I was all bloaty, and he was all sucked up from using product. And so we went to the Big Island, and we grew pot on the Kona Coast. It was hard work. It paid so poorly. I have never been a successful criminal. I just cannot make money that way. It's a lot easier to just get it, you know, just work. Anyway, but I didn't give it up because why would I? You know, but let me tell you something interesting that happened. Okay, so I'm over there on the Big Island on a cattle ranch growing this pot, working my ass off. And you know, all the bloat's going away. But I don't have access to alcohol because the state of Hawaii isn't giving food stamps for booze. So I got crazy. So that's weird. You know, I went over there to get healthy, and I was getting healthy, physically healthy. But I didn't have alcohol, so I got crazy. Postage stamp. I mean, what do you call it? Post-it note. This is, you know, so I had to go back to the mainland a couple of times to get a vacation from living on the Kona Coast. And then we got, you know, sold the grow and went back to the mainland and grew pot for a couple more years in Oregon. And that was a little bit better because, you know, out in the sticks. But again, it's out in the sticks. I'm living out in the sticks. I'm always living away from people. It's always like I'm trying to control things. But when I started drinking, I really felt like that what I got was so big because I felt like I was my own God. I could decide what was important and what I cared about and, you know, and what I didn't care about. Well, I can't get married. I've never seen a good marriage, so I know that I can't do that. I don't want to be a parent because, you know, I don't want to bring a child up in this terrible world. Like I was contributing anything to the world. You know, it's like that in education. Well, I didn't think I could do it, so I didn't even try. I just gave up. You know, high school, I managed to graduate. That was far as I could go, but I was pretty good at figuring how to cut coke and also how to grow pot. I grew some good pot, but I couldn't, I couldn't keep a relationship. And one day I noticed that that the guy that I've been living with for all those years, he had his clothes in a dresser, and my backpack was sitting next to the dresser. That's where I had my clothes. So that was another what that. You know, I mean, I couldn't see myself. Let's fast forward. Well, I'll tell you why I got sober. I got sober because from when I was in my early 20s until I got sober at 27, I could no longer reliably get drunk. And that guy, he gave me this 1968 Ford Galaxy and some money to go away. Apparently, the not liking each other was a mutual thing. And isn't it beautiful when things play out that way? So, bye. Okay, so I land here. I mean, literally, like, I land here in Los Angeles. I never lived here before, and I thought it's a big town, and nobody knows me, and I'll get tanned, rested, and ready, and go back up to the Bay Area and find myself a junior executive. And I'm sorry, honey, but that was my plan. So, but no. Instead, I got a couple of jobs, waitressing, and I met Stuart's mother and his aunt. And I love those women, and his mother gave me his card. She said he makes a lot of money. He'll spend it on you. And she said to him, well, she's pretty, but she's not very bright. So, you know, I mean, that's like perfect. So we met, we married like that. And we drank together. And yes, I did hide bottles from him because you can't trust a drunk, for God's sake. Am I right, Pam? You cannot. I mean, seriously. Okay, but, you know, then we give each other the side eye because one was more drunk than the other. It was ridiculous. We do target practice in the living room. We lived in Silver Lake. You know, we do target. We had a bale of hay in the living room. You know, because whatever. Anyway, so yes. So Denny told us both we were going to rehab, and Stuart, he went in a couple of days before me, and that's why he's got 2 days more than me. So, which is delightful. And but he told me, like he said, told me, you know, I was trying to be a wife. I didn't know how to be a wife. That he didn't know whether he was going to drink again. And I'm so lucky that the idea was introduced to me, because I never thought, from when I was 18 years old and I told myself I'm not going to drink today, because it was one of those crawling to the toilet days, and I was drinking that afternoon, I knew I couldn't stop. But alcohol wasn't working for me. I was between a rock and a hard place. I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink. I needed out, and I knew I was going to go to the thing I'd never used. I'd used everything else, but I'd never used that. And I knew I just couldn't go up through any more hell. So I went. And by God's grace, I heard before I got out of my beat-up Volkswagen how important alcohol was to me. And I went in anyway, and I was diagnosed when I walked in there. And the people there had the diagnosis. They had a course of treatment. And they had proof that it works. It really does. And that's where I heard an H&I panel come in. And the woman who was 13 years sober at the time said that she'd asked God to remove the obsession to drink. She said it had worked for her. She said, you can try it. And I believed her. I believed her. I didn't believe somebody that was blue on the floor, you know, for years. I didn't believe the stuff that happened to me. It didn't touch me. I didn't believe this stuff. I never learned from, I believed her. And I went and I kneeled by my bed and I had a profound spiritual experience. When I turned to God, God rushed to me. And what I felt was infinite love and peace. And I got up after that experience passed. And I wanted to find Patsy, my roommate. I wanted to find Stuart, my husband. I wanted to find somebody to tell them about this thing, this love and service that we are told is foundational to this program, is apparently instinctive. It's in there. It's part of our DNA. I got a sponsor. I did the steps. I did my fifth step in my third week of sobriety. I started, you know, I did H&I panels. We went down, we lived in Silver Lake, we went to Skid Row, we went to treatment centers. I mean, like Stuart said, I've been going to prison, to Tehachapi Prison since 97, and I've got some prison dudes here with me that I've gone to prison with, and we go to Lancaster, although they haven't opened up again, but I love that, and I learned how to be a friend from my sponsor, Sherry Taylor. I've had, I think, 7 sponsors, my sponsor. I've lost 3. I mean, you know, 41 years is a while. And so I get to sponsor women. I get to see this program change people's lives. And the great thing is that it's not like it changes people's lives just at the beginning. It's an ongoing conversion. It's an ongoing growth. It's supposed to be. We're supposed to keep on learning, keep on growing. And I love to be here. I love to be back with you. Over the last, whenever, 20 years that we've been on lockdown, I was already going to like 7 meetings a week. Or more, you know, sometimes accidentally. Like I used to end up in different states accidentally. The same thing happens in sobriety. But over the past, whatever it's been, 20 months or something, I've gone to more meetings than I've ever gone to before, because I could. But I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky. I love you. Thank you so much.
This next person, I came to a quandary. One of my speakers, if you look at the program, isn't here today. And when she called me, I thought, what do I do? Do I subject them to me talking, or do I ask another person? And this lovely woman agreed to speak with us today, Tara. Thank you so much. My name's Tara, and I'm an alcoholic. And for those of you who did come to hear Carla, I'm sorry, you're stuck. They closed the doors, you're not getting out. I do want to thank Harriet. Fran had called me the other day and said that Harriet, who I hadn't, I don't even know Harriet till now, was looking for somebody to fill a spot, and would I do that? And I said, okay. And then that day, Harriet called, and she didn't, like, give me a test. She didn't ask me, you know, to meet any criteria other than, will you do this? And I said, yes. And so, I wanted to thank Harriet for having faith in Fran, and then Fran for having faith in me. And that's how it works here, you know, is that when I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody gave me, well, they had 20 questions, but they didn't, you know, they didn't ask me all of these things to let me in the doors. They just let me in, and they said, here's your seat. And every time I came back, they had a seat for me because they had some faith that I didn't have, you know. And so today, even though I've just met Harriet, I have a whole host of faith in her. I have faith in every one of us sitting out there, you know, because of the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. You know, I'm so glad to see a lot of friendly faces out there, though. And Don, he lives just a few blocks from me. And I see him in the mornings on the way to work. He's out walking his dog. And it just is such a nice thing to see him. Sorry, I got to take this off because my glasses keep fogging up. And so in June, I'm going to be retiring. And I thought, Don doesn't know it, but I've got plans for him. You know, I'm going to be stalking him on his walks and walking with him. Because we've talked and stopped and talked a few times. And it's just such a lovely thing to have that, you know. Okay, I'm just a little nervous. And then I just start freaking out. My first drink was at 13, and by the time I had that first drink, I was ready for it. You know, I had some childhood trauma. My father had deserted the family. My mother was pregnant with twins, and we had ended up on welfare. And just, you know, life was not what I had thought it was going to be. And I was full of shame and resentment. Just had a horrible, horrible view of what the world was and my place in it. And so that night that I had, I didn't have a drink. I had a whole bottle, and I ended up with my spending the night in the bathroom with my head in the toilet. And I felt so good. I could not wait to do that again, because that night I just felt okay. You know, some people talk about, you know, drinking and now I can dance. I just felt okay. You know, all of that, that shame about who I was, about who my family was, about what our circumstances were, all of my resentment at my parents and my siblings and our circumstances, they didn't go away, but they mattered a lot less. You know, so alcohol from that very first night became my solution. You know, I believe that that night I crossed the invisible line, because after that, I didn't have any drinky poos. I didn't work my way into alcoholism. I drank like a pig from the beginning. You know, I didn't become a daily drinker from that point because I didn't know how. You know, I had to learn how to, you know, find the people who drank a lot. And I did very quickly. And right away, I found out that that I drank differently than my friends. You know, they'd get a little buzz happening, and they were cool. And I'm like, but that's only like half a beer. You know, what? And, you know, so I would go around finishing people's drinks. You know, I learned how to stand out in front of 7-Eleven and ask old guys like Don to buy me beer. And they would do it. And, you know, so I didn't know at the time because I didn't have the vocabulary, but that phenomenon of craving developed as soon as I took a drink, and I had to have more. You know, there were a couple of times where I would realize that the situation I was in, that it was not enough, and so I made the decision not to drink because I knew that there was not going to be a way to get more, and I wasn't going to be able to handle that, you know. By the time I was 16, I started making the rounds of the psychiatric hospitals, always as a result of a drinking episode. And I loved that. I loved going to the hospital. I liked making stuff. I liked the outings. I don't know why, but I was never, they never gave me meds. You know, God probably knew. That was not a good idea. But, you know, for me, it was like Club Med. You know, it was respite from that horrible family, from those horrible conditions. You know, finally, something about me, you know. Although I didn't do anything to change me because I thought it was them. It was people, places, and things that were my problem. And I wouldn't drink and get in trouble like this if those things were better, you know. But I also thought that I did those things because I was this horrible person. You know, I knew by second grade I was going to hell, you know, because I made my mother crazy. And why are you always doing those things, Tara? You know, why? And I could never be enough. And yet when I drank, I was okay. Even though I was always insanely drunk. But I was okay inside, you know. And my last trip to the hospital, they said, you know, when you leave, you need to do something different. And I thought, well, duh, you know. But I thought, well, I'm not going to go home because Mom has not changed. They're still on welfare. They're still, you know, I'm not doing that. And so another option was to go to Camarillo State Hospital. That was before it was a university. And I thought, well, I'm not that bad. Because I knew a girl that went there, and she went there because she used to kill the ducks at Reseda Park. And I thought, you know. So the third choice was to go to a girl's home in Hollywood. And that, to me, was, I had arrived. Because I knew about Lana Turner and Schwab's, and I was going to get discovered, right? I did get discovered by every sleazy guy that drove down the street that had a bottle of booze. I would get in the car with them, you know? So it was just another opportunity for me to continue my drinking. But this house said, you know, if you want to continue to live here, you can't drink. You need to do something about that. And they said, we don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but we've heard that it works, and we want you to go. And so I went to my first meeting at 17, and there were probably about this number of people in the meeting. Very nice, very friendly, very clean, you know, but very old. Not quite as old as you guys, but old, okay? And I thought... And the speaker that night talked about, you know, yeah, you know, one of my drinking, I was drunk and I left Tennessee and I came to in Texas and everybody's laughing. And then, oh, yeah, and then I realized that my infant son was in the back seat and they're laughing. And I thought, this is terrible. Why are you laughing? These, you know, I didn't get it, you know. But like I said in the beginning, you know, people welcomed me. They made sure I had a seat. Do you need a ride home? Here's our numbers. You know, do you need a ride to the meeting the next night? And when I'd show up at the next meeting, hey, we're going to coffee. Get in the car. You know? And so I kept coming because I wanted to stay at that house. But what happened is I didn't stop drinking because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I really belonged here with you, but you kept me coming back because I didn't understand. I didn't understand how come you weren't like telling me how disappointed you were in me every time I raised my hand as a newcomer. You know, I had just taken a 38 chip the night before, and yet tonight I'm raising my hand as a newcomer again. And you didn't judge me. Well, you might have in your mind, but you didn't act that way towards me. You know, you just welcomed me again. You know, get in the car, we're going to coffee. You know, here's my number. And, you know, I know today that that's the unconditional love of one alcoholic for another, and that that was the attraction that kept me coming back long enough so that when I did finally hit that bottom, admit that I was alcoholic, I knew I could come back here. You never closed the door on me. You know, and that's so important for me because that's what, you know, that's really what I do in sobriety today is I make sure that the door is open. You know, that night when I came back, I didn't plan on that. You know, I had long moved out of that girl's home. I had an adult job. I had this, you know, crappy apartment in Reseda, and I didn't know how to manage my money. My utilities were cut off, and I had adopted a cat with fleas, and I would come home from this little job and sit in the dark with my cat and scratch and drink, and I thought that that's as good as life was going to get, because that's what I deserved. You know, that's the kind of life that I deserved. That's, you know, God had abandoned me, and that was fine because I didn't, you know, want anything to do with him. He had done nothing for me. All of my prayers had gone unanswered, you know. Never occurred to me that I treated God like Santa Claus, you know. But that night, I sat there, and I thought, you know what, I can't do this anymore. But my solution was not Alcoholics Anonymous. My solution was suicide. And I made my little plan, and I got up to go do that, and I had that moment of clarity that so many of us have. And I heard, it was my voice, but it wasn't my voice. And the voice said, Tara, you need to not drink. You are an alcoholic, and you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the first time that I ever had that thought. Every other time it was like, oh, I'm going to be good now. I'm going to never drink again. I'm going to, you know, I'll be a good girl. I got to go clean up, you know. I got to go, I don't know what, but I'm going to go back to AA. But this time there was something different. And I went back to a meeting that night, and I know that everybody sitting in the room that I had seen for those 4 years, you know, they looked up and they saw Tara, and it looked the same as it always did, you know, but I felt different. And that night, the speaker, it was the first night that I had no differences. The first night that I sat there and I identified. You know, I always thought that, you know, well, I didn't do this and I didn't do that. And that night, those things didn't come up. I had no reason not to be here. And that was on October, well, the next day was my sobriety date, October 5th of 1980. And I had just turned 21 like a couple of weeks before that. And when I'm on my 21st birthday, my goal was to... I'm now going to get to go drink at Club Reseda. Club Reseda was this dingy bar that for some reason, you know, I don't know why, but that was my aspiration to become a barfly, you know, because most of my drinking, you know, if we could sneak into a bar, you know, that was very dimly lit, we could get away with underage drinking, but mostly it was drinking at, you know, in the park or, you know, some other sleazy place, you know, because I would go anywhere or do anything for the price of a drink. And
You know, so I had no plans to get sober. But that night, God had other plans, you know, and I had that window was open just enough to let something in, some of that grace that we are allowed here, you know. Now, from that moment to this, what's happened is that, and I've heard a couple other people this weekend talk about this, you know, is I thought being human was the character defect, you know. And what I've become in Alcoholics Anonymous, in addition to being sober on a daily basis, is a human being. And most of the time, that's acceptable with all its flaws and, you know, quirky little crazy things that come with being a human. And I was thinking about last night's speaker talked about enthusiasm. And I thought, well, you know, I'm enthusiastic, but I'm not the kind that goes screeching down the hallway, you know, and like a schoolgirl or something. That's just not me. It's never been me. But I am enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous because it saved my life. I was listening to Stuart and Diana, and I thought, dang, they were bad. They were bad alcoholics. And I know kind of Don's story, and I'm kind of like a panty waist. I mean, I got arrested once, but they handcuffed me to a chair at West Valley, and just I had to wait for my mommy. You know, I mean, like, I didn't even know you got free booze in Vegas until I got sober, and then I was pissed. And you know, but you know, the thing is, I don't have to out-drunk anybody in here, and I don't have to out-recover anybody in here. You know, because what brought us here was, you know, because what I heard from Stuart and Diane was what I related to, which was that I lost all control when it comes to alcohol. You know, regardless of how far that took us or where we landed. But the fact was, is that every time I took a drink, I had to have more, and I could not control that. And I was powerless over alcohol, you know. And then when I come here, what keeps us together is a common solution. And the book says we all agree on what that is, you know. And that's so comforting to me. You know, because, you know, I always wanted directions. I always wanted, like, you know, the book about how to do stuff. And now I have one, you know. And it tells me things like how it works and that there's a solution. And all of the answers to the things that happen in my life are in that book, you know, and in the experiences of other alcoholics. You know, and we all have a place here. You know, I was at the general service meeting this morning, and oh, no, you guys weren't there. Sorry. Anyway, there was like five of us. But, you know, I've been involved in general service. I've done H&I. I've done all kinds of levels of service, you know, from greeter to coffee maker to, you know, being secretary, all different things. You know, because that's how I show that enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I make myself available. And I, you know, and then I was thinking about Don again, you know, and just seeing him in the mornings. And he doesn't even know that I see him sometimes, you know. And it reminded me of when I was about 9 years sober, I was working at Central Office, and a guy came in. And he was like, he saw me, and he was like, so happy to see me. And I thought, who are you? I didn't know who he was. And it turned out that when I was new, he was newer than me. And he would see me at the Friday night meeting at the Nest. And I was always sitting up against the wall, you know, kind of mad. And but I was always right there. And he said, you know, every time I came, I saw you in that same seat, and it gave me such hope.
And I thought, you know, sometimes just showing up and having and taking my seat is being of service to someone else, because we never know what someone else needs. You know, that's not my business. That's God's business. And, you know, I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me a life that is so different than what I thought life could be. You know, I'm not ashamed anymore, mostly. I'm not, you know, I'm not as angry as I used to be. But I do love a pandemic, because when I put my mask on, I don't have to hear people say, "You should really smile more." So I really am a very happy person. But at any rate, I'm so glad to be here. I hope you're having a good convention, and keep coming back. Again, I want to play with this. I always want to play with things. You know, when I got sober, my sobriety date's April 15th, 1981, and I got sober, and I was one of the weaker ones walking in. So if you're here and you're new and you don't think you can make it, I was positive I couldn't get 30 days. I was positive once I got 30 days, I couldn't get 60. I did not think I could get this program. I felt that I was not good enough for it. But there was a man, I got sober between Chandler Lodge and Radford, 4343 Radford, the real Radford. And every time I walked in the room, he would greet me. He was kind. He was loving. And that's my friend Don.
Still got it.
Yeah.
My name's Don Morgan, and I'm an alcoholic. I got 55 years of sobriety. But I need one more day. And that's what I'm working on today. I love this program. I love what it's done for me. You know, I'm practically illiterate. And that's the truth. I have a very, very poor education. Not because it wasn't there, but because I wouldn't do it. Like everything good that came down the pike, I wouldn't do it. I'll show you. And that's the way I'd always been. Until I found this program. And this program was given to me a few times, and I turned it down. When I was very early on in my my drinking, boy, when I was very early on when I was drinking, I was about 12 or 13 years old. I used to, when I was 9 years old, I lived in a trailer park, and they used to play cards in this room, and I'd go pick up all the cigarette butts, and I'd smoke these cigarette butts at 9 years old, thinking I was really something. And I lived across the street from the beach in a funky little trailer park, which is gorgeous now. And I'd get up on the hill smoking these cigarettes, and I'd throw dirt clods at cars, and they'd screech, "You little asshole, it'll come up and get you." I'd go, "Fuck you," you know, and it just made me feel so big and so, and anyway, that was my start, and I just couldn't wait to drink. You know, I used to, my old man drank quite a bit, and every once in a while, I'd steal a little sip out of whatever he left over, and by the time I was 13, I was a pretty good little thief, and I used to have older guys that liked me because they could send me into a liquor store, and I'd buy a pack of gum and come out with a jug, and never knew what it was, and just grab something and come out. So I never had too many favorites, but they were all good. And, you know, I just... By the time I was 13, my mother divorced my dad when I was two, and she married another guy, and they had a child, my sister, and my dad got remarried, and he had kids, and I always felt like odd man out. They both had these families, and I was, you know, and it wasn't that they didn't love me, but I felt that way. I felt unloved and different because I wasn't the new kid. And my stepdad liked to drink. He got drunk one night, and over, I think it was in Glendale, they had a, you know, the trains used to have those things come down and you'd stop and it'd go right through town in the old days. Anyway, he bumped into a car and got out and staggered over and looked in the window and see if he did any damage. And he staggered back to his car after the deal went up, and a drunk ran over him and killed him. So my poor mother had my little sister living at an aunt's and uncle's, and I was living with my dad, and she wanted to get us back together. So she went to work at the Palladium. One of those cute little cigarette gals, that was my mom. Anyway, she married the head bouncer there because she wanted to get us back together. And I said, man, I wish you'd have planned a little better than that. His name was Ed Ton, T-O-N, 6'6", 265 pounds, and didn't like me. And I didn't like him. But Ed had a bunch of guns. And by the time I was 13, I used to look in my mom's mirror and I'd go like that. And, yeah, get one of these. You don't need an education. And I believed that. And I wanted to be a gangster. Anyway, I got tired of just looking at that mirror and pulling the trigger, and there was never any bullets in it. So I found some bullets. And I put one in there, and I played Russian roulette with it. Finally, it went off, and I missed the entire mirror and shot a hole in the little bit of wood around it. I wasn't even a good shot. Anyway, so I ran away when I was 13, packing a gun. I used to put it here, right here in my belt. I took the bullets out because I didn't want to shoot something off, if you know what I mean. That took a little of the toughness out. Hang on, I'll be with you in a minute, you know. Anyway, I was packing this gun, and I'm showing everybody that I'm packing, you know. And just thinking I was really something. And I got arrested in Pasadena carrying this gun. And they took me down to the police station. And they said, what's your name? Well, gangsters, tough guys like me, don't give up their name just because you ask. I said, I ain't got one. I'm 13. I look like I'm 9. The cop said, I said, what's your name? And I said, I ain't got one. He took one of those saps out that help you with your memory. He slammed it down. It missed my hand, but the wind was real fierce. I said, my name's Don Morgan. I live in Burbank, California. I've always hated that. Tough guy like me giving it up that easy. Anyway, they sent me to a boys' home out here called Pacific Lodge Home for Boys. We used to have AA meetings there 175 years later. But anyway, I'm in this boys' home, and they're having me sweep the grounds and do funky stuff. And I'm going, do they know who the hell I am? I'm probably the only one in here that got thrown in here packing a gun. And these assholes got me sweeping. So anyway, third day I'm there, I'm talking to one of the other kids, and he says, so you don't like it here? I said, no, and I ain't staying here. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm leaving. He said, you know, they catch everyone right away when they run away from here. I said, yeah, you're all dumb. You go right down to Ventura Boulevard and hitchhike. I'm walking. They'll never catch me. He said, can I go with you? Sure. So him and I ran away, and we're out walking and hiding, and we come up on a, he says, where are we going to sleep? Like I was going to rent him a motel or something, you know. I said, oh, we'll sleep in one of them hay bales, you know, and so we did. And he said, I'm cold. God, what do you want me to knit you a blanket, you know? Anyway, it was tough being this tough and being and running with guys like that. Anyway, I stayed out for a long, long time for being 13 and on the street. And I ended up down in Tijuana, Mexico. And it was during the war, World War II, not Civil War. So anyway, I'm sleeping on the ground in Tijuana at 13. In the morning, I wake up, and there's a bunch of little Mexican kids that took me and bought me something to eat and said, you want to make some money? Get these sailors and bring them to these girls. It's called pimping. So anyway, I brought one sailor to one girl and did 8 days in jail down there at 13. Anyway, that's my background. Why did I drink? Because of my background. Anyway, I drank and drank and drank. I've been married 4 times. I got in the movie business, so that was three of those were rehearsals. I'm on The Keeper now. We've been together for 32 years. She's on this program. I love her to death. I love her more. Every time I see her, I love her a little more than the time I... Anyway, we got a great marriage. We got a great dog, which you've met. And I walk the neighborhood, and I excite old women. You know, with my education, I shouldn't have gotten anywhere. I used to get fired at every job I ever had, drinking, arguing, fighting, doing something wrong, over and over and over, never amounting to anything. I met a guy when I was about 20. He took me to Radford. And he said, you need to sober up. And he took me to Radford. And I thought he meant sober up once in a while. That they had a way of doing it without it hurting you too much. And I thought that's what you did. So he brought me to Radford. And they started talking about a day at a time and everybody bragging about how much time they'd been sober. And I thought, shit, I ain't coming back here. So for 13 more years, I never went to AA. But every time I went to jail, every time I got drunk, every time I was in divorce court, every time, well, blah, 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 I'd think of those guys. I bet they're not doing this. So finally, a couple of other times I tried a little AA. Wife number 3 got tired of me getting drunk all the time, and she said, why don't you go back to the AA? So I said, all right. So I went to a few meetings, and I still didn't. I never read the book. I never did any, you know, anything. And I finally got a job as an animation cameraman. My dad was an animation cameraman, and this guy knew my dad and gave me a chance, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I got laid off, and I met this other guy in a bar that said that he could give me a job in live action. So anyway, I got thrown in jail for drunk driving that night. And I called my new little wife, number three. She was, I think, 18 or 19. 19 when we got married. And I called her and I told her I was in jail, and she's just yelling at me and telling me what an asshole I am. And I said, I'm not having fun. I'm in jail. Don't you, you know, they don't understand. Anyway, I came home and she said, you got to go back to AA. So I went to a few more meetings, you know, and I got sober, and I got a chance to go to work for a guy that did aerial photography in the movie business. And I went to work, and the first job that he sent me on my own, he gave me $100 per diem and sent me a first class ticket to Philadelphia. And I was to meet a cameraman, put the mount together in the helicopter, and show this guy how it worked and send him on his way. Anyway, I'm up in the airplane, and they said, wheel a cart by, and he said, Mr. Morgan, she was very cute. She said, Mr. Morgan, would you care for a drink? And I'd never been called Mr. Morgan, so I didn't want to hurt her feelings. And the AA's way down there, and I'm way up here, and, you know. So I says, yeah, I'll have a drink. Well, you know what it's like when you pour a drink in one of us. You got to have another one to wash it down. And then another one and another one. Anyway, I got off that plane and I was drunk. And I went up, I went into, I had $100 per diem. I went into the bar trying to buy a new friend and got drunker and drunker and went upstairs and puked in the bed. And I didn't make the call the first day on my own in the movie business. That's alcoholism. The phone rang and the guy says, Mr. Morgan? I thought he was going to eat me out for being late, and I said, yes. He said, sorry we didn't pick you up, but it's raining outside, and we can't do the shot today. We'll have to do it tomorrow. Is that all right with you? Puke all over the bed. And I, yeah, that's fine. So the next day, I sobered up, and I did the job. Then I went to another job right from there to a rental company to show them how to put this together, this mount. And the guy said, would you like to have a few drinks? So we went out and, you know, forgot about that other day. Got drunk. The next day I'm supposed to be showing him how to put stuff together. I got a hangover and he's going, does this wire hit? Yeah, I think so. And anyway, I went to the airplane the next day. Nice, beautiful, sunny day, big white airplane, first class ticket back to L.A. And I'm thinking, if that guy didn't find out I got drunk on both jobs, I'm never drinking again. So I never have drank since that day, November 5th, 1966. So I went back to AA. I went to a lot of meetings. I never opened the book. I never did any steps. I thought, I didn't do this crap in school. Why am I going to do it here, you know? What do they know I don't already know? I know how to be drunk. Anyway, I wouldn't do anything. I was sober for 8 years. 8 years without doing anything in AA. And then I met the guy that became my sponsor. And he said, I said, could I come up and visit you and talk to you about AA? And he said, yeah, come on up. So I met him, and he said, how long have you been sober? I said, 8 years. Who's been your sponsor before me? I said, I never had one. And he said, what have you been doing around here? I said, well, I sponsor a bunch of guys. He said, you do what? I said, I sponsor about 8 guys. He said, what do you talk to them about? I said, AA. He said, you don't know nothing about AA. And I'd been here 8 years. And I said, well, you know, they're sober. He said, not because of you. Anyway, he just jumped down my throat, and he got me into the book. He got me working the steps. And I've never had a bad day since. I have bad moments, but he taught me not to drag that moment through the entire day. So I don't have bad days. I have bad moments once in a while. I don't carry it through and it's a thing that's drilled in my head. I just don't have bad days. I have good days. Because I got into the book and I found a God of my understanding, which was very limited. But I let God in. I let you guys in. He told me to cut those guys loose that I sponsored while I still had a chance. So I'd call them up and tell them I had to cut them loose. And one guy said, screw your sponsor. I like the way we work this program. We don't do nothing. So I had to hide a baby. Anyway, if there's any of us in here that isn't doing the work, and I hate the word work. You know, I became a cinematographer. I don't know how to spell it, but I am one. I became that aerial guy, and then I started working once in a while on the ground. I bought a book of 100 famous paintings and started copying the lighting and started doing a little bit of lighting and started getting a name. And I've shot some big movies and I've shot some television shows. I've been nominated 9 times for Emmys and I've won 8. How does that happen to a guy that can't spell Emmy? You know, I let God in, I let this program start working, and I can't even believe the life I have. I'm married to the loveliest gal I've ever known in my life. She came after me. I'm the one that always chased after someone. She chased after me. She called me on the phone one night and said, you know, Don, I'm guilty of not working all my steps. I was wondering if you could help me with the 13th step. She told her girlfriend what she said, and the girlfriend said, Patty, do you know what that means? Yeah, it means I want to get to know him. Yeah, in bed. She said, oh, no, you're kidding. She said, she really didn't know what the 13th step meant. And I really did. She called me the next day after leaving that message, and she said, Don, I'm so sorry about that message. I didn't know what. I said, don't worry about it. I only listened to it about 10 times. Anyway, we started running around together, and we got married. And we've never had a bad day. We've probably had a couple bad moments, but never a bad day. And I thank each and every one of you guys for saving my life. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you, Don. I hope you guys have had as much fun as I have listening to these four. Let's give them another round of applause. I've done a few of these, and this just makes me feel great. It says 182 years of sobriety, and I think that's about right because God has it that way, that's all. Will those new friends in their first year of sobriety please stand? Everybody with any amount of time sober, get their numbers. Stand up. Everybody keep standing. Get their numbers. This is what we're here for. Okay, would those with 9 months or less remain standing? Anybody with 9 months or more, sit down. Otherwise, if you have less than 9 months, keep standing. 6 months or less.